I'd like to express my deep gratitude to the Master of Trinity College, Sir Gregory Winter, to the Council of Trinity College, and to the Fellows of Trinity College for welcoming me here. I would like to thank Professor John Marenbaum for his many kindnesses. I didn't know he's here. There he is. For his many kindnesses in getting me here, as well as Dr. Ross Wilson and Dr. Phil Knox for the work in organizing these events, and indeed, Dr. Knox for, or Dr. Wilson, sorry, for introducing me so kindly. It's a great honor to be here. I'm delighted to see everyone attending. So this is part of a larger project called Unmodernism, and the first installment of this is called Hegel in the Cathedral. So Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, that German philosopher of the early 19th century, I'm sure you've heard of him, especially if you teach and research in the humanities, though it's entirely likely that this thinker has now been, as it were, memed into public consciousness for several decades now, really ever since 1972, when Monty Python produced for West German television the brilliant skit Philosopher Football, Germany versus Greece. It's a great sketch. The first words by the commentator, played by Michael Palin, are, "Here come the Germans, now led by their skipper, Nobby Hegel," unquote. Soon enough, the match begins, and they're off, says the announcer, at which point the teams play nothing resembling football, everyone instead desultorily ambling about the field in their togas and tailcoats, lost in their heads, some gesturing to themselves in deep thought, others strolling around in every direction while reading from a philosophical tome held just so. All goes slowly, and the camera pans around the field looking for any significant movement whatsoever. Suddenly, we focus in on Archimedes, who exclaims, "Eureka!" He takes the first kick. Now there's action on the field. The ball goes to Heraclitus, who, as we're told, beats Hegel, passes to Socrates, who then himself scores. The Greeks go wild. The crowd roars. But wait, what's this? The Germans are disputing the goal. The commentator is now breathless, tripping over his words, trying to describe what the Germans are saying to the referee. If you know the skit, you may remember what comes next. Above all, perhaps, you recall Hegel's protest. As the commentator frantically reports it, "Hegel is arguing that the reality is merely an a priori adjunct of non-naturalistic ethics." Once more time, slowly, "Hegel is arguing that the reality is merely an a priori adjunct of non-naturalistic ethics," end quote. This is truly my favorite moment in the skit. A high point for me because the gibberish gets Hegel wrong and it doesn't even matter. The joke is on Hegel, and if I had to absolutely kill the joke by explaining it even more than I already have, I'd say it's funny not only because it's gibberish, but because it's a particular kind of gibberish suited for a distinctly modern philosopher. Hegel here is a caricature of a caricature, the example of an ostentatiously modern subjectivity that so projects itself out into the world, or so swallows up the world into itself, as to consider reality to be merely a reflection of the mind. And at least to academic types, it's fun to joke like this about the potential subjectivism and solipsism of modern philosophers, even if it means getting them wrong, be it George Berkeley, who says that to be is to be perceived, or René Descartes, who says, "I think, therefore I am." A joke like this only works, in short, with modern philosophy. To think of Hegel as a modern philosopher, however, isn't all fun and games, or at least it's not all games. The question of Hegel's modernity and the particular quality of his modernity is one I'd like to pursue with you tonight. To be sure, much depends on how you define modern, but if the historical timeline is any guide, as it most certainly should be, we could simply cite the dates of Hegel's birth and death, 1770 to 1831, and feel confident that we can proclaim Hegel to be modern, ending our discussion there, which would make for a very short Clark lecture indeed. Yet the dates on Hegel's tombstone in Berlin tell us nothing about the quality of his modernity. We have to look at other aspects of his work to understand what makes his modernity even worth querying. For instance, you could discover his modernity in his prose style. Read Hegel, and you'll quickly gather that no one writes like he does. That's because he forgoes systematic exposition, whereby the philosopher defines his or her terms, lays out his or her propositions, and defends them in a manner of presentation reminiscent of everyone from Aquinas and Spinoza onward to Wittgenstein and beyond. Hegel instead does something totally new, adopting a dense and dizzying style whose philosophical importance requires an amount of guessing by the reader. It's not for nothing that the poet John Berryman, in one of his so-called dream songs, wrote, quote, "Come touch me, baby, in his waking dream," disordered Henry murmured. "I'll read you Hegel, and that will hurt your mind," unquote. If you need a second opinion on the matter of Hegel's style, take it on no better authority, no better reader of Hegel than the young Marx, who writes the following in a long letter to his father, quote, "I had read fragments of the Hegelian philosophy whose grotesque, rocky melody did not please me," unquote. For more recent readers, the problem boils down to this. If you like the way Hegel writes, he's a modernist. If you hate the way he writes, he's a postmodernist. It's not only Hegel's style that marks him as modern, however. You could say that he is a distinctly modern philosopher in the way he thinks about freedom in relation to its opposite, namely necessity, doing so in a rather up-to-the-moment fashion. On the one hand, he talks about the French Revolution as a time of great excitement, bordering on the French acceptation of this term, excitement, when Hegel, with his timely coiffure a la Titus, his Roman Titus haircut, recounts the moment he saw Napoleon astride his muscular white horse during the Battle of Vienna. On the other hand, Hegel held the revolution responsible for the ensuing Age of Terror, and he reflects on the consequences of what philosophers called the general will, which in Hegelian terms means unconsidered, non-reflective public opinion that makes populism seem appealing. You could say Hegel is modern in his focus on civil society and his understanding that reason and rationality can shape such societies. To it, he's modern in the way he idealizes the state as an ethical whole or indeed ethical substance, which, if you follow his analysis, is one big bureaucracy of competent technocratic middle managers. You could say he's modern in his evident love of Luther and in general Protestantism as a post or even anti-medieval phenomenon against, as Hegel says again and again, the abuses of the church in the Middle Ages, where his chief complaint among others seems to be that you'll catch a cold sore sharing the sacramental wine with fellow parishioners. We could go on sorting through examples like these until we alight upon what makes for many thinkers modernity modern in broadest terms, which is to say capitalism. There's a long tradition of thinking that holds Hegel to be a philosopher of capitalism. And here I am thinking of Marx, Lukács, Adorno, and Horkheimer, among others. For all of these reasons and more, Jürgen Habermas aligns Hegel with the so-called philosophical discourse of modernity, which subsumes all the topics and problems I've just referenced by terms like modernism, modernity, and of course, capitalism. Well, now that we got that exercise done, we're sufficiently warmed up to say something about what makes Hegel's modernity peculiar. It's this peculiarity that attracts a medievalist such as myself to Hegel. Perhaps it's easy to see why, if you hold the view that, quite simply, Hegel lived in the Middle Ages. To begin with, Hegel was born in Württemberg, a feudal kingdom that, as Terry Pinkert says in his excellent biography of Hegel, quote, had survived into the modern world, unquote. As a boy making his way to the Stuttgarter Gymnasium Illustre, whose curriculum was a mix of medieval and Enlightenment training, Hegel looked upon a town everywhere shaped by the old guild system. Apart from the university in Berlin, the German universities he could have attended were all semi-feudal corporations with inherited medieval privileges. Hegel, however, chose the seminary in Tübingen, where he donned on all occasions, a long black monkish coat, the appropriate garb for a medieval city and university. Right from the seminary in Tübingen, he gained employment in an aristocratic household as a private tutor, more or less a domestic, another very old social station. During his downtime as a private tutor, he read works of English modernity in the household and translated an anti-Bernese pamphlet attacking the quasi-feudal system, upon which that same household, his employer, depended. When he arrived in Nuremberg to take up his job at the gymnasium there, this was in the years 1808 to 1816, he found himself in a fundamentally medieval academic institution run by guilds where, in the absence of toilets, was really the icing on the cake. In Heidelberg, whose beautiful ruined castle overlooked the town, you can catch a stunning view it on the Philosophenweg, and whose university dates from the early 14th century, Hegel participated in a medieval network of exchange, accepting supplementary payments for his work the old-fashioned way, in kind. By this time, and in these contexts, Hegel had written many important works, including, but not only, the Phenomenology of Spirit, the Science of Logic, and the Encyclopedia of Philosophical Sciences, and he was just beginning to lecture on aesthetics. Meanwhile, he was on the verge of publishing The Philosophy of Right in 1820. I could go on, but this is enough to propose to you that any idea that Hegel was unproblematically, uncomplicatedly, unquestioningly a modern philosopher must account for the fact that Hegel lived in a decidedly unmodern time, an age when the Ancien Régime didn't disappear overnight because a certain French assembly on the 11th of August, 1789 said so, declaring emphatically, quote, "The National Assembly destroys the feudal regime in its entirety," unquote. None of the authoritative histories of France tell us that feudalism ended so abruptly or even entirely. This is an issue I'll address more directly in my second Clark lecture called Marx After Feudalism. Suffice it to say that there's a very broad historical point to make here about economies and modes of production in Hegel's day, in which most of the population labored under servile obligations that extend back in time for centuries and which were fundamentally medieval. James J. Sheehan, in his magisterial book called German History, 1770 to 1866, documents the fact that the German states remained feudal in Hegel's own lifetime and beyond, stating, quote, "Freeholders and some lessors were legally free, even if the latter were often caught in a web of servile obligations because of the way they held their land. But many and probably most German peasants were personally subject to one or more lords. They lived in hereditary subjection, which limited their rights to move, marry, and do certain kinds of work," unquote. Sheehan, at a later point in his history, gets a second opinion on the matter of the German peasants, writing, quote, "After reviewing 5 centuries of agrarian history, Jerome Blum concluded that in the middle of the 18th century, the face of rural Europe looked much as it had in the Middle Ages. The great mass of people lived at the narrow margin of subsistence, as much as at the mercy of the shortage of food as their forebears had been in the 13th century," unquote. Even after 1750, when there were improvements in agricultural processes, organization, and education, Sheehan insists that we, quote, "should not overestimate the rate or extent of change in the German countryside," unquote. What we have in Hegel's day is Grunderschaft, or landed lordship, which assumes pre-capitalist forms of agrarian production performed by peasants, whose surplus is extracted by a landowner, be it another peasant or lord, strictly through political or coercive means, through the exercise of power characteristic of late feudalism. Okay, so moving now to the next section. This section's called Hegel's Philosophical and Modernism. We can now raise the problem to another level. Any idea that Hegel was unproblematically, uncomplicatedly, unquestioningly a modern philosopher must also account for the fact not only that Hegel lived in a decidedly unmodern time, but that he did decidedly unmodern things, took up decidedly unmodern themes in his philosophy. Let's look, for example, at his most well-known contribution to philosophy, his episode concerning the master and slave, what's often called the master-slave dialectic. You may know this one, and I'll suggest here that Hegel writes this episode as a way of thinking about late feudalism as, and here's the catch, late feudalism as a modern phenomenon. Rather early in the Phenomenology of Spirit, Hegel tells a story about a master and a slave that is, on the one hand, extremely abstract, and on the other hand, as concrete and clear can be. Now, this passage is abstract because Hegel's story of the master and slave begins as something else, namely as a tale of two consciousnesses who encounter one another in a scene or place so lacking in details as to be something like pure space. If I may assume the role of John Berryman's disordered Henry, I'd like to murmur out to you some Hegel to give you a sense of this kind of abstraction. And your job here will be to listen, but don't worry about following exactly what he says. Quote, "Self-consciousness splits into the extremes, and each extreme is this exchanging of its own determinateness and an absolute transition into the opposite. Although as consciousness it does indeed come out of itself, yet, though out of itself, it is at the same time kept back within itself is for itself, and the self outside it is for it. It is aware that it is at once and is not at once another consciousness, and equally that this other is for itself when it supersedes itself as being for itself, and for itself only in the being for self of the other," unquote. One more time now, right? Okay. So how's your head? Okay. From here, two consciousnesses face off in a struggle to the death, each seeing the other as a threat to its existence. As the exposition continues, things change. Each consciousness decides that this approach is no good, for if you kill the other, you kill desire, you kill any opportunity for mutual recognition, and quell any possibility for intersubjectivity. Even if you engage in this sort of conflict half-heartedly, staging half-assed incursions, flybys, and such like, you risk losing your own personhood and conceptualizing the other as a thing to be destroyed. The point being that if recognition and intersubjectivity is what you're after, then you have to stop this struggle to the death. And if you cease, then congratulations, you're ready to be a person in society. It's here that Hegel's story of the two consciousnesses moves from abstraction to clarity, right at the moment Hegel assigns names to these two abstract figures, personalizes them, and infuses them with sociality. It's also here that Hegel writes a sentence that is apparently the most difficult for interpreters to understand, and which we must now suffer to hear, turning us all into disordered Henrys and Henriettas. Unlike our football commentator, I will read out the passage very slowly. Hegel writes, quote, "One is the Lord, and the other is the bondsman," unquote. Well, that wasn't so bad, was it? Matters couldn't be clearer. Hearing and reading that declaration, we appreciate that the two consciousnesses are now two people. Perhaps even more importantly, however, we realize that the terms master and slave, which almost every single reader of Hegel uses to talk about this important episode, are bad translations of Hegel's German terms, which are Herr and Knecht, which mean lord and bondsman, respectively. Both of these are feudal terms describing individuals occupying two very different places within Grunderschaft, or landed lordship, as I had discussed earlier. Hegel, in other words, gives us nothing short of a classic feudal scene in this moment in the phenomenology of spirit, in which the lord and the bondsman struggle not to the death, nor for recognition, but rather for the possession of one thing they have in common and that forces them into a relationship, namely land. As Hegel shows us, while the bondsman works the land, the lord simply enjoys it, interposing himself between the bondsman and the land as a matter of legal and political right to consume its fruit, its yield, which is the bondsman's surplus. The lesson of the story is that intersubjectivity is linked to, or is yet another kind of material interdependence, and that soon a classic dialectical reversal will be the result of such material interdependence, where the lord is revealed to be entirely dependent on the bondsman, as to render the bondsman himself and herself as master or lord. And that whole reversal opens up onto Marx, as you can see. Now, some of you may know that I have discussed this episode elsewhere with different emphases and with a ridiculous amount of documentation drawn from all of Hegel's works, as well as a great deal of historical sources only a medievalist would think to marshal. And this argument has in turn provoked an amount of debate between modernizing interpreters of Hegel, who prefer to read the entire passage totally abstractly, so that it can be read allegorically and applied to any situation, any kind of struggle across history, okay? And those who can see that Hegel resolves the scene into clarity about medieval feudal problems. Old habits die hard, however. Hegel's interpreters like what they like and know what they know, which turns out to be, I'm afraid, an understanding of Hegel, nay, a misunderstanding of Hegel, that goes all the way back to Alexandre Kojève in the 1930s. Who influences an enormous amount of French philosophy and subsequently North American analysis of Hegel. In one of his lectures, Kojève declares the following, quote, "Hegel characterizes the condition of domination very sketchily in the master-slave dialectic, for if the master genuinely existed, he would be God," unquote. Kojève was a fascinating figure, a brilliant man, and indeed a key contributor to the modernist and modernizing trends of reading Hegel. But when Kojève reads Hegel like this, he's not really reading at all, and can't seem to interpret the simple aforementioned sentence, which again says, in all of its supposed numinous mystery, quote, "One is the Lord and the other is the bondsman," unquote. And failing to make sense of this single sentence, Kojève rather makes things up. The master would be God? Why? Hegel's text does not point to this at all. No, if the master genuinely existed, as Kojève says, as the master authentically did in Hegel's age within Grunderschaft, he would be the heir. He would be what he's called, the Lord, full stop. The common misreading of Hegel involves an even greater misunderstanding of how our philosopher describes his own historical present. How, in other words, he thinks about the modernity, or better, the contemporaneity of the episode between the Lord and the bondsman. We can observe quite straightforwardly that Hegel uses this episode to illustrate modern subjectivity. You heard that right. Hegel uses a medieval scenario to illustrate a feature of modernity. Now, I do not mean here a kind of subjectivity about which one might joke and jabs about Nobby Hegel. Rather, on offer here is a version of the modern self that attends to the problems of self-consciousness and desire, and that depicts the dynamics of a lowercase e existentialism in which an other always looks in on you at the wrong time and slows you down and gets in your way. The Lord Bondsman scenario is a lesson that our encounters with the other aren't simply phenomenological dramas in which only appearance and show are at stake, but rather it teaches us that such encounters are often a struggle over resources and material goods. This scenario is also an exhibit in self-definition through labor and self-destruction through the alienation of labor. For all of these reasons, Hegel situates the Lord Bondsman scenario in a chapter called Self-Consciousness, and he points up its temporal significance and modernity by saying, quote, "Consciousness first finds its turning point to self-consciousness in the daylight of the present," unquote. This should strike us as a wonderfully strange idea, that what's modern for Hegel is medieval, and that what's medieval for Hegel is modern. But all that strange isn't so surprising if we take into account Hegel's historical context and the way he thinks generally about history and the longue durée. Okay, so this section is called periodization. It's now worth noting that the Lord Bondsman scenario isn't the only example supporting this claim about the modernity of the medieval, as if to say that all of these conclusions rest on the outcome of my philological quibble with some guy from 100 years ago over a few pages out of the Phenomenology of Spirit. No, a good deal of Hegel's historical thinking and philosophy illustrates this idea about the modernity of the Middle Ages. This is my next major point, which will take us into Hegel's aesthetics and eventually into a certain cathedral, our final destination. We'll be thinking now about why Hegel is captivated by not only the modernity of feudal forms of self-possession, but also the modernity of what's called the Gothic style and Romanticism. If, as I suggest, Hegel is fascinated with the modernity of feudal forms of self-possession, showing that modern self-consciousness begins there in the Middle Ages, then he must have some quite odd and different ideas about historical periodization itself, that habit of slicing up time and labeling it either medieval or modern, or really labeling it neither or both. He must, in other words, have a unique perspective on what makes one historical period different from another or like another. To be sure, sometimes Hegel is happy to let his disciplinary focus inform his views of historical difference. For example, when he's thinking within the discipline of history, as he does in his lectures on the philosophy of history, he supplies a restricted notion of modernity, which begins quite exactly and eventfully in 1789 with the French Revolution. Yet if we turn to his lectures on the history of philosophy, we discover that modernity begins earlier, with what Hegel calls the philosophy of modern times, which starts with Descartes in 1637. Neither of these two constructions concerning the modernity of the French Revolution and that of Renaissance philosophy is a surprising way to designate historical periods. But these two examples alone reveal to us Hegel's flexibility, or rather his resistance to the idea that all the pieces must always line up when talking about the past, as if he had to have some unitary notion of a historical period. He doesn't demand that modern politics requires modern philosophy or vice versa, and indeed he remained open to the idea that in some disciplines and practices, modernity is reached sooner than in others. Which brings us to art, the discipline of art history, and the philosophical field that goes by the name of aesthetics. Here, Hegel generates his most intriguing ideas about periodization and modernity. In his lectures on aesthetics, Hegel discusses three major artistic periods: the symbolic, the classical, and the romantic. The bulk of his thinking, by hundreds of pages, in fact, goes to the romantic period, whose chief art forms are painting, music, and poetry. So what does Hegel say about the Romantic Age that's so special? To begin with, for Hegel, the Romantic period is crazily vast. It runs from the founding of Christianity to its present day and includes what we would call late antiquity, the Middle Ages, early modernity, the various enlightenments and counter-enlightenments, and for all the debates about the meaning and temporal reach of the term, the Romantic period itself, as Romanticism. Yes, Hegel's a big thinker, but this seems a bit preposterous. At your peril, do you pack some 1,800 years of art history under a single rubric? Now, a lot can be said about Hegel's conception of the Romantic period, but let me offer two ideas. The first, picking up where I left off when I noted that a different disciplinary focus yields for Hegel varying definitions of the modern. By that logic, then, in his lectures on aesthetics, Hegel indicates that art gets to modernity before philosophy and politics, meaning that you could live in a world that gives you modern art, but medieval philosophy and feudal politics. This also means that Hegel both inaugurates a great dialectical tradition wherein aesthetics is the domain for political thinking and utopian projects, and it also means that Hegel invents the very concept of uneven development, about which I'll say a little bit more below. The second point, apart from the one of this kind of unevenness, is that the Romantic period for Hegel is a long modernity and includes the moments we never think of as modern, but rather designate as pre-modern, like the medieval period. It's a long modernity for one very simple Hegelian reason. As Hegel says everywhere in his works, with modernity comes self-consciousness, and such self-consciousness is only founded in the Middle Ages and not therefore in classical antiquity, which is the age of consciousness without intersubjectivity and recognition. Now, I'm just the messenger here on that one, but as Hegel sees it, the great historical break in Western Europe on questions of subjectivity isn't between the medieval and the Renaissance, as literary scholars in both fields are so accustomed to hearing and rehearsing to their respective chagrin and delight. There is no subject in the Middle Ages, the subject was invented in the Renaissance period, and so forth. Rather, the break is between the antique and the medieval, with the former on the side of classical art and conceptions of the self, as figured in Hegel's famous Reflections on Antigone, and the latter, the medieval, falling on the side of a modernity named the Romantic period. So what are the stakes of including the medieval within the modern? From one point of view, it shouldn't be a surprise that the Romantic includes the Middle Ages in light of the fact that the Middle Ages are everywhere in Romanticism. From the medieval word at the very center of that era's and that discipline's name, Roman, to the invention of the Gothic and other ubiquitous neo-medievalisms, such as you see in, say, Novalis, whose musings about medieval churches probably required a cold shower afterward. Indeed, Schlegel, in his ruminations on the Romantic, includes some select medieval works within that category, but the difference here is that his definition of the Romantic doesn't involve historical periodization, as it does for Hegel. Rather, Schlegel calls Romantic any canonical, antique, medieval, or modern work he himself happens to fancy. Yet any question of style, Romantic or otherwise, asks after its purported opposite, substance. Or perhaps it's better to seek what motivates such a style, be it another style in itself or something else. It's here that we turn to context once more and entertain the unbelievably simplistic proposition that there is a Gothic revival within Romanticism, a preoccupation with neo-medievalism alongside classicism, because at the time there was a considerable amount of Gothic architecture and medieval infrastructure still standing and there to behold, not all of it in ruins, and much of it functional and very much a part of what comprised the present. You can see that I'm returning to my earlier theme about Hegel, the way he dressed, the institutions he attended, the jobs he held, which all partook of centuries-old traditions. I now will try to embroider the claim about the persistence of the Middle Ages to suggest that Hegel's inclusion of the Middle Ages within Romantic modernity is less a product of Romanticism, less the question of some new style in reaction to some other old style, and more a result of the fact that, as I stated forcibly at the outset, Hegel lived in the Middle Ages, or if we prefer, the Middle Ages lived in Hegel's modernity. And so now, this is, I think it's the penultimate section, but it's the section that's about Hegel in the cathedral. I'd like to think more about Hegel's discussion of Romantic architecture and propose to you that in the same way Hegel uses the Lord Bondsman dialectic to discuss modern subjectivity, In the same fashion, Hegel describes the Middle Ages as the beginning of modernity. So too does Hegel consider the medieval cathedral to be the form through which to think about modernization. And not in the way you might expect. Certainly not in William Wordsworth's way, where the medieval Tintern Abbey is largely absent from the poem whose title bears its name, and in which, in any case, you go a few miles up from the abbey, as the title of the poem says to do, and you run into populations displaced by enclosure and industrialization. Go in a different direction, and you get coal mines. In other words, with Tintern Abbey, all you get is modernity and no abbey. No, Hegel thinks differently about the medieval cathedral and does not pose modernity as a threat to its beauty, to say nothing of its existence. It's not squeezing the cathedral out. It's not squeezing the abbey out. So here he is, Hegel, in a letter dated the 28th of September, 1822, to his wife Marie, in which he talks about the Cologne Cathedral, which he was so thrilled to visit. And reading Hegel's letters is such a relief, right? So let's read some of his letters together. Okay. He writes, "Cologne is huge. I searched out the cathedral right away. It's worth seeing and is wholly admirable as the enterprise of a single city. In the cathedral, one vividly beholds in every sense a different dimension, a human world of quite different sort, as also of another time. There is no question here of utility, enjoyment, pleasure, or satisfied need, but only a spacious ambling about enveloped by the high halls that exist for themselves, and, as it were, simply do not care whether people use them for whatever purpose. An empty opera house, like an empty church, has something lacking in it. We encounter here a tall forest, though admittedly a spiritual forest full of art, standing for itself, existing there regardless of whether people crawl around down below or not. It could not care less. What it is for itself. It is made for itself, and whatever ambles or parades about within its walls is simply lost in it. All of the standing and walking around in it simply vanishes in it," unquote. So yes, Cologne is really, really huge, this cathedral. It has the largest facade of any cathedral in the world, if you include its two towers. At the time Hegel was recording his observations, however, the cathedral was unfinished, and a crane for lifting stone still stood in place from the Middle Ages on one of the half-completed towers. Both towers were only completed after Hegel's death. Hegel certainly recognizes the cathedral as a thing of the past, as a building from another time. Yet oddly, Hegel is disinterested in its mystic or religious significance, saying that the space is rather like an empty opera house that's perfect for spacious ambling about for whatever purpose. Just go in and amble about, whatever. Right here, Hegel is contradicting himself. As he says in his Aesthetics, architecture must be, quote, subservient to some purpose, unquote. That's kind of what defines architecture in relation to art for Hegel. His association of the cathedral with the opera house, a very post-medieval construction itself, doesn't help clarify the purpose. If anything, it helps Hegel advance the very motif of the empty building, which is duplicated across the two named buildings, cathedral and opera house. This is odd, too, because Hegel says elsewhere that, quote, a temple requires a congregation, or otherwise it is only a box, unquote. So Hegel's cathedral, like that empty opera house, is a box. I find this claim quite provocative in the way it strips the cathedral down and makes it an empty container, makes the cathedral a holder of space. Of course, empty space is never just mathematical volume or a quantity, even if it remains an abstraction. For empty space takes on all sorts of qualities in modernity when we're talking about public space, whether it is the cliche about the space between people as inherently distancing, alienating, and empty, or whether it's the empty urban spaces that are so large as to induce agoraphobia, a disorder first described in 1871, and that registers one sort of response to the new urban spaces. Hegel's cathedral is empty not because it is neglected, but because, as Hegel goes on to say, it is there standing for itself. It is indifferent to what transpires inside its space. As Hegel writes, what it is for itself, it is made for itself. Maybe we're meant to cringe a little here reading a private letter like this to Marie. His words aren't romantic in any conception I know of. But in saying that the cathedral is for itself is to say it is not for another, which is to indicate that the cathedral isn't bound up in the problem of meaning. It doesn't project sense outside itself. It doesn't acknowledge an other. It gives forth no idea. This seems like a small point, but it is not very Hegelian of Hegel to talk like this about architecture, because usually for him, architecture and symbolism, the significance of its symbolism, are always linked topics. What breaks these two things apart, symbolism and architecture, is the modernity of the cathedral, not so much its secularization, though one can certainly account for that process here, as much as its continued use as a civic space in an urban setting. The cathedral verges on becoming an ordinary building, but for the fact that Hegel declares the cathedral to be wholly admirable as the enterprise of a single city. Inside its space, people wander around and get, quote, simply lost in it. All the standing and walking around in it simply vanishes in it, unquote. The cathedral appears to be a space of evanescent experience for this single city, much as the new urban spaces themselves would soon foster this quality of fleeting experience within their built environments, and which would forever be depicted in literature and art as so many collected solitudes, everyone together, busy being alone, a feeling so beautifully figured by the city windows lit at night, illuminating 100, then 1,000, as in Theodore Dreiser's Gleam of 1,000 Lights in Sister Carrie, the separate private worlds within worlds. Granted, I'm leaning on this letter quite a bit and going fast here, but that's because Hegel instills Hegelian philosophy in this missive while also going off script in key ways that raise questions about what exactly he's trying to conceptualize here. I'm also going heavy on this letter on account of the fact that Hegel writes, what he writes to Marie, he recycles in his lectures on aesthetics in an astounding correspondence between personal and public texts. I don't think anyone has noticed this either. And this puts us, along with Hegel, back inside the Cologne Cathedral, where he assumes the role of tour guide, shepherding us around and directing our attention here and there, meanwhile conceiving things he doesn't really ever formulate fully. So here we are in lectures on aesthetics now, reading out. Quote, "In such a cathedral, there is room for an entire community, for here the whole community of a city and its neighborhood is to assemble not round the building, but inside it. For this reason, all the various interests of life which touch religion in any way have their place alongside one another. The wide space is not divided and narrowed by a series of rows of pews. Everyone goes and comes unhindered, hires or takes a chair for his present use, kneels down, offers his prayers, and departs again. If it is not the time for high mass, the most varied things go on simultaneously without inconvenience. Here there is a sermon. There a sick man is brought in. Between the two, a procession drags slowly on. Here there is baptism. There a funeral. At another point again, a priest reads mass and blesses a couple's marriage. Everywhere people wander like nomads, on their knees before some altar or holy image or other. All these varied activities are included in one and the same building. But this variety of occupations and their separate individuality, with their continual alteration, disappears all the same in face of the width and size of the building. Nothing fills it entirely. Everything passes quickly. Individuals and their doings are lost and dispersed like points in this grandiose structure. The momentary event is visible only in its passing away. And over everything, these infinite spaces, these gigantic constructions, rise in their firm structure and immutable form. These are the characteristics of the interior of Gothic churches." Unquote. Hegel is back on script here, temporarily at least, writing about religious activities within the cathedral. So we know the cathedral is, as it was, still in use. Obviously, he has a broad idea of religion here, as, quote, all the various interests of life which touch religion in any way. From there, Hegel generalizes about this activity, adding no further discussion of religion. He's rather more interested in philosophizing about it as, once more, something like a secular urban allegory. Here he goes off script in ways that recall his letter to Marie, in which he talks about the transience of experience, what of human activity vanishes in the cathedral. He states that, quote, all these varied activities are included in one and the same building, but this variety of occupations and their separate individuality, all of these varied activities are included in one and the same building, writes Hegel. He continues, but this variety of occupations and their separate individuality with their continual alteration disappears all the same, unquote. Hegel is intrigued by the gathering of what he terms, sounds redundant, but separate individuality. He tells us that, quote, everything passes quickly. Individuals and their doings are lost and dispersed like points in this grandiose structure. The momentary event is visible only in its passing away. Yet Hegel again seems to be figuring a kind of modernity within this space, within the frame of the medieval cathedral, a modernity of civic life that can only be apprehended totally in its passing, and only in its collection of so-called private individuals, much like the Parisian arcades, whose construction began in Hegel's time in the early 19th century, and which for Walter Benjamin signaled a shift to modernity in the way, among other ways, it collects everyone as private individuals, a term and insight that works well with Hegel's aforementioned separate individuality, and which opens up onto the soon-to-be collected solitudes of urbanization. In his final words in the long quotation, Hegel thinks at one additional remove and makes the cathedral a type, referring to cathedrals plural, not as empty spaces, as before in his letter to Marie, but as infinite spaces. Quote, over everything else, these infinite spaces, these gigantic constructions rise in their firm structure and immutable form, unquote. It's impossible to imagine an infinite space, but perhaps that's the point in this gesture to think what can't be thought, a totality beyond knowing, a thing of the past that accidentally becomes the vehicle for thinking a future already unfolding in the present. Evidently, only here in the cathedral can Hegel qualify his contemporary moment, his own modernity as involved, however elusively, in modernization as we come to know it. Hegel is limited here, and he's far from Dreiser, needless to say. He can only figure this vanishing experience in his lectures on aesthetics precisely because he does not consider contemporary architecture to be worthy of inclusion within his said lectures, which of course is his own silly problem. But there it is, and it is what it is. It puts Hegel in mind of what's contemporary, what's vital, what's active, what's real, and not merely real, within a cathedral that's within the city, that's within the cathedral. The cathedral is his frame for making modernization legible, as if the cathedral itself can reduce the city or amplify the town to its basic elements, make them visible, and collect the separate individuals, all busy with their own affairs, irrespective of each other, only to vanish within something much larger than themselves, with no idea how or that they comprise a whole, and with a whole that doesn't give a damn that they do. Yet that larger something, that totality, that cathedral is still available to representation and description, unlike the modern city, which is infamously not, however indifferent it seems to be as well to its inhabitants. It's why novelists, just a few decades later, figured forth the city metonymically, the electric wires and railways and Dickens's Our Mutual Friend, along with everything else that enters into a given modern novel's scenes like indoor plumbing, radiator heat, electric lights. Of course, you can make the city a central subject of your novel, or even take on the project of characterizing an industrial city as Dickens famously did in Bleak House. But be ready to write some 900 serialized pages of fiction to do it. I claim that the cathedral is Hegel's frame for making modernization intelligible, or at least legible. In saying this, I have in mind Marshall Berman's book, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, The Experience of Modernity, which identifies a certain generation of people after 1789, and Hegel was born in 1770, who would on the one hand witness the modernization of cities, while on the other hand recognize what Berman says are, quote, worlds that are not modern at all, unquote. Berman titles his book after a quotation from the Communist Manifesto, in which Marx and Engels say, quote, All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned, unquote. For them, this simply means that the Middle Ages and feudalism evaporates in the advance of capitalism, the rise of the bourgeoisie, and the expansion of the world market. Yet what we find in Behrman and what I find in Hegel, and even in some of his contemporaries, is an epistemological matter, whereby the older infrastructure becomes the cognitive frame within which new forms of urban life are imagined, or for that matter, made intelligible. The spectator of this history has a combined experience of the old and the new that results in equally combined, but no less dynamic, or for that matter, dialectical, expression in art, literature, and philosophy. For his part, Hegel offers us the conflate image of the cathedral not in a generalized modernity so much as in a specific kind of urbanization, wherein the cathedral is not a space of mystery, romance, and religion, as we see in Balzac's Master Cornelius, but rather a space of activity of every sort, a social totality in miniature, an infinity built out of heavy stone that has lasted over the centuries while the people inside came and went. In other words, Hegel's cathedral isn't a phantom or spectral past made present, as we see in other imagined encounters between old medieval towns and new modern cities, such as Jiří Kareszek's novel about Prague, published in 1900 and called A Gothic Soul. This novel opens with the warning that, quote, fiction is eternal, reality perishes, invented forms live, real ones vanish, unquote. This maxim prepares us for and reflects the psychodrama of the novel's protagonist who, quote, was sick. He felt it. He could find no peace. It was as if all the atoms of his soul had been vaporized, unquote. This might remind us of Marx and Engels' own theme that all that is solid melts into air, precisely on this question of the erasure of the medieval in modern cities. This kind of anxiety, at least this modern version of urban anxiety, is motivated certainly by such obliteration. And I understand this response. But with apologies, I say, Marx and Engels do not understand this response. One needs more. One needs an account of what lasts, of what persists, as the real, unghostly, non-spectral forms and structures in the lived environment of the present. Unmodernism is the title for my Clark lectures. It's a term I've come to use that I hope answers to the need for an historical analysis and historical periodization that won't reduce the past to all that melts into air, that won't regard the past as so many ruins and metaphors, that won't repeat the now tired vocabulary about the past as traces, allegories, absent presences, palimpsests, specters, ghosts, and all the other quote-unquote hauntologies of some contemporary philosophical discourse. I speak of unmodernism knowing full well that it's most frequently used in the field of architecture and art history, but it also in the discourses and practices of real estate. For example, there's the unmodern architecture in the Netherlands as a counter-movement to postmodernism. There are unmodern residential buildings in Cyprus, where it is inadvisable simply to assume that the unmodern in its persistence can be revalued as postmodern, as just another cultural style among so many styles on offer. There's those real estate notices that you, my kind audience, have surely seen in which the unmodern features of a given property in the UK and Europe are said usually to be a bonus, a selling point, identifying what's authentically very archaic, but still quite functional about the living space, such as a medieval fireplace. I choose unmodernism then as a working concept because it effectively expresses the fact that some things lie outside of modernization, that in some cases the past is not totally erased, its structure is not totally destroyed, and the great modernist and modernizing projects from the time forward of Le Corbusier's City of Tomorrow, in which we are exhorted to, quote, construct for today, by clearing away from our cities the dead bones that putrefy them, unquote. Indeed, unmodernism is distant from such modernisms because it is not reducible to style, nor at least not in all cases, not reducible to rubble. I choose unmodernism as a means to think about how the past shapes our action in the present, how it contains it, how it channels it, on a range of scales and within a variety of spaces, from doorways and stairways to walkways and motorways that were once deer paths. There's potentially global significance in this term, but I'll leave that for another time. For now, I simply want to say that I find the word on modernism to be compelling and perhaps even useful to develop an account of the past that at least attempts not to be so prejudicially modernizing. Thank you.